Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Susanna Clark, author of the international bestseller Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell, published by Bloomsbury. In the weeks to come, we have Neil Gaiman reading from his smash hit, Anansi Boys, Robert Hicks and his best-selling The Widow of the South, and Monty Roberts will discuss his new book, The Horses in My Life. You can visit www.tatteredcover.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. I see Susanna Clark coming to the podium. It's time to begin.
Thank you so much for coming and supporting our events, and thank you for choosing independent bookstores. And before we begin, I just always ask if people could silence their cell phones and pagers just for the good of all. The quote by Neil Gaiman says it best. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Morell is unquestionably the finest English novel of the fantastic written in the last 70 years. It's funny, moving, scary, otherworldly, practical, and magical. It's a huge book filled with people it is a delight to meet, and incidents and places one wishes to revisit, which is, from the beginning to end, a perfect pleasure. Closing Jonathan Strange and Mr. Morell after 800 pages, my only regret was that it wasn't twice the length. Susanna Clark lives in Cambridge, England, where she is at work, you will be happy to note, on the next book in the world of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Morell. Please, Mr. Norell, please welcome Susanna Clark.
Good evening. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming. I'm going to talk a little bit about the influences that made Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell, and then I'm going to read you a short passage from the book. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell was begun in a house that overlooked the North Sea. My father is a Methodist minister, and in the early 90s, my parents had to choose their last church before they retired. And rather typically of them, they made this choice based not on which church could offer them the most comfortable home or where was the most convenient location. They chose the place that they thought other ministers were least likely to pick, the place that no one else would want to go to. And so they ended up in a very depressed ex-mining village on the northeast, the very northeast coast of England, a place with the Bronte-esque name of Blackhall Rocks. I have to say the people there were some of the friendliest and nicest that we've ever met. And in 1992, I was unemployed for 6 months. And in the grand tradition of 30-somethings who find themselves unemployed, I went to stay with my parents for an indefinite period. The house there was possibly the coldest and the dampest that I have ever lived in. But it had this one great advantage. From it, you could see the sea. In fact, most of what you could see from those windows was the grey North Sea. And the countryside around the village was very beautiful and very northern. And while I was there, I would go for walks along the cliffs and through the fields and through the denes, which are very narrow little valleys, almost like cracks in the high landscape that are full of trees and plant life and animal and bird life, like secret valleys in the landscape. And I would think about the book that I wanted to write. I looked at empty hills and black birds flying across huge northern skies. And out of that landscape grew Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell. Despite all of the big all of the scenes in London and all of the big events that take place on the battlefields of Europe or in Venice, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is a book that begins and ends in the north of England, and which describes some of my love of that northern landscape. Even magic itself, which at the beginning of the book is a matter of books and spells and libraries, becomes by the end an aspect of English landscape. It's something that's made out of English bones, out of the bones of the English landscape. For me, as for other writers of the fantastic, magic and landscape seem to be inextricably entwined. And I'm thinking here of people like Ursula Le Guin, and particularly of the English writer Alan Garner. Now, at the beginning of 1993, I took up a publishing job in Cambridge. And every time that I've come south, to the south of England, after a period of living in the north, it's been borne in upon me that in many ways England is two countries. And this time, the contrast between economically depressed Blackall Rocks and wealthy Cambridge, where there's not only the university, but there's very thriving IT industry, lots of technology. This time, the contrast was really, really sharp. And so it's no surprise then that in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, there is this medieval history that underpins the 19th century events of the book. And in this history, England has been two kingdoms in reality. And as a small act of revenge for the north upon the south, I made English magic come from the north of England. Now, I'm a magpie sort of a writer. I collect things that attract me, and I lay them all out, and I try and find patterns and stories to connect them up. And I made Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell out of the bright, shiny things that I love, out of magic and winter landscapes and firesides and descriptions of books and libraries and the social comedy of Jane Austen and the London of Charles Dickens. And I made the narrative voice of the book out of the voices of other English writers. As well as Austen and Dickens, I think there's a bit of C.S. Lewis in there, a bit of E. Nesbitt, and perhaps a bit of Arthur Conan Doyle. And over the past year, it's been fun for other people to try and unravel these voices and influences. My late agent, Giles Gordon, couldn't find any Jane Austen at all and was amazed when I mentioned it. Some people don't hear Dickens, but do hear Trollope. Some readers have thought that everything about Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell becomes crystal clear the moment you realise the profound influence of the 19th century Welsh fantasist Arthur Machen. Unfortunately, I've never read a word of him, so I couldn't say. And then there was an interviewer on Polish Breakfast Television who, 10 minutes before we were about to go on live, asked me whether I had read Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita, and seemed at first amazed and then personally offended when I said that I hadn't. I think he was intending to base the entire interview around that, and consequently, I didn't seem to go very well. Just before Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell was published last year, a very kind and more experienced author was giving me tips about how to handle publicity and interviews. But she was rather worried by my insistence on calling Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell a fantasy book. She said, "You ought not to say it's a fantasy book. Tell them it's a fantastic book." But I have never been in any doubt that Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is a fantasy book. For one thing, it's got magicians and fairies in it, which I think gives you a clue. Also, I'm rather proud of that fact. While I was writing it, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and Ursula Le Guin were my heroes and my models. And I'm also grateful for all of the support that I've got from other fantasy writers while I was writing it. I think that the fantasy and science fiction community is particularly helpful and supportive to new writers and unpublished writers. One of the questions I've been asked a lot over the past year by journalists is, why is fantasy so popular nowadays? And every time I hear it, I kind of think the question is somehow back to front, because it seems to me that it's always been popular with readers. It's just that with the advent of Harry Potter and the success of The Lord of the Rings, it's more in the media now. Journalists are taking more notice of it. A more interesting question might be, why is fantasy important? Now, I think there are people who could give you a better answer than this, than I can, but I'm going to attempt one anyway. I think the first thing to say is that great fantasy books tend to have great stories. And I think publishers and critics have tended to underestimate how much readers love great stories. And fantasy seems to me to be a particularly concentrated form of story, a story where not just the characters and the situations are invented, but the natural laws and supernatural laws of the universe itself. For some people, reading about a world that never existed can only ever be escapism, and escapism can never be a good thing. This is what I have to say to that. While I was writing, one morning while I was at work on Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, I got a phone call to say that my brother had died very suddenly and unexpectedly. And this happened a week or so after the third volume of Philip Pullman's trilogy, His Dark Materials, came out. And I had bought it in hardback. I never bought books in hardback, but this book I had bought. Reading that book got me through the initial period of shock and bereavement. If you've read The Amber Spyglass, you might be a bit surprised by that, because, not to give anything away, in it, Pullman describes what it is like to be dead, and he doesn't make it a pleasant thing at all. In his book, the dead are not having a good time. But this didn't bother me at all, because I didn't believe that. The story was what mattered. I could pick up that book, and for a while I could find some respite, and I could find some peace, and I could find some strength to go on with those very difficult weeks. This seems to me something more than escapism. In fact, it seems to me rather different from escapism. Stories can do many things, but as Philip Pullman's Amber Spyglass proved to me, stories can help us bear pain, and stories can help us heal. Now, I'm going to read to you a piece in which Jonathan Strange does some magic. At this point in the book, Strange and Norrell have re-established magic in England, and they've helped the British against the French in the Napoleonic Wars. And as a small reward for this, they have been invited to the port of Portsmouth, where they have been wined and dined, and a ball has been held in their honour. And the next morning, Strange is woken rather early. Just to sort of describe the city of Portsmouth. Portsmouth was at that time a very important port for the main naval port of England, and the anchorage, which lay directly in front of it between Portsmouth and the Isle of Wight, was called Spithead. Having got to bed a little before 3, Strange was not best pleased to be woken again at 7 by a knock on the door. He got up and found one of the inn's servants standing in the hallway. "Beg pardon, sir," said the man, "but the port admiral has sent to say the false prelate is run upon Horse Sand. He has sent Captain Gilby to fetch one of the magicians, but the other magician has the headache and will not go." This was not perhaps as perfectly comprehensible as the man intended, and Strange suspected that even if he had been rather more awake, he would not have understood it. Nevertheless, it was clear that something had occurred and that he was required to go somewhere. "Tell Captain whatever it is to wait," he said with a sigh. "I am coming." He dressed and went downstairs. In the coffee room, he found a handsome young man in a captain's uniform who was pacing up and down. This was Captain Gilby. Strange remembered him from the ballroom, an intelligent-seeming man with pleasant manners. He looked greatly relieved to see Strange and explained that a ship, the false prelate, had run upon one of the shoals at Spithead. It was an awkward situation. The false prelate might be got off without serious damage, or she might not. In the meantime, the port admiral sent his compliments to Mr. Norrell and Mr. Strange and begged that one or both of them go with Captain Gilby to see if there was anything that they could do. A gig stood outside the Crown with one of the inn servants at the horse's head. Strange and Captain Gilby got into it, and Captain Gilby drove them briskly through the town. The town was beginning to stir with a certain air of hurry and alarm. Windows were opening, heads in nightcaps were poking out of them and shouting down questions. People in the street were shouting back answers. A great many people seemed to be hurrying in the same direction as Captain Gilby's carriage. When they reached the ramparts, Captain Gilby halted. The air was cold and damp, and there was a fresh breeze blowing off the sea. A little way out, a huge ship was lying on her side. Sailors, very small and black and far away, could be seen clinging to the rail and clambering down the side of the ship. A dozen or so rowing boats and small sailing vessels were crowded round her. Some of the occupants of these boats appeared to be holding energetic conversations with the sailors. To Strange's unnautical eye, it looked very much as if the ship had simply lain down and gone to sleep. He felt that if he had been the captain, he would have spoken to her sternly and made her get up again. "But surely," he said, "dozens of ships go in and out of Portsmouth all the time. How could such a thing happen?" Captain Gilby shrugged. "I am afraid it is not so remarkable as you suppose. The master might not be familiar with the channels of Spithead, or he might be drunk." A large crowd was assembling. In Portsmouth, every inhabitant has some connection with the sea and ships and some interest of his own to preserve. The daily talk about the place is of the ships going in and out of the harbour and the ships that lie at anchor in Spithead. An event such as this was of almost universal concern. It drew not only the regular loungers of the place, who were numerous enough, but also the steadier citizens and tradesmen, and of course every naval gentleman who had leisure to go and see. A vigorous argument was already taking place over what the master of the ship had done wrong and what the port admiral must do to put it right. As soon as the crowd understood who Strange was and what he had come to do, it was glad to transfer the benefit of its many opinions to him. Unfortunately, a great deal of nautical language was employed, and Strange had at best an indistinct impression of his informant's meaning. After one explanation, he made the mistake of inquiring what beating off and heaving to meant, which led to such a very perplexing explanation of the principles of sailing that he understood a great deal less at the end of it than he had at the beginning. "Well," he said, "the chief problem is surely that she is on her side. Shall I simply turn her upright? That would be quite easy to accomplish." "Good Lord, no," cried Captain Gilby. "That will not do at all. Unless it is done in the most careful manner imaginable, her keel would almost certainly snap in two. Everybody would drown." "Oh," said Strange. His next attempt to help fared even worse. Something somebody said about a fresher breeze blowing the ship off the sandbank at high water caused him to think that a strong wind might help. He raised his hands to begin conjuring one up. "What are you doing?" asked Captain Gilby. Strange told him. No, 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 cried the captain, appalled. Several people seized Strange bodily. One man started shaking him vigorously, as though he thought he might in this way dispel any magic before it took effect. The wind is from the southwest, explained Captain Gilby. If it grows stronger, it will batter the ship against the sands and almost certainly break her up. Everybody will drown. Someone else was heard to remark that he could not for the life of him understand why the Admiralty thought so highly of this fellow whose ignorance was so astonishing. A second man replied sarcastically that he might not be much of a magician, but at least he danced very well. A third person laughed. "What is the sand called?" asked Strange. Captain Gilby shook his head in an exasperated fashion to convey he had not the least idea what Strange was talking about. The place, the thing on which the ship is caught," urged Strange. "Something about horses?" "The shoal is called Horse Sand," said Captain Gilby coldly, and turned away to speak to someone else. For the next minute or two, no one paid any attention to the magician. They watched the progress of the sloops and brigs and barges around the false prelate, and they looked to the skies and talked of how the weather was changing and where the wind would be at high water. Suddenly, several people drew attention to the water. Something odd had happened there. It was a large, silvery something with a long, oddly shaped head and hair like long, pale weeds waving behind it. It seemed to be swimming towards the false prelate. No sooner had the crowd begun to exclaim and wonder about this mysterious object than several more appeared. The next moment there were a host of silvery shapes, more than a man could count, all swimming towards the ship with great ease and speed. "What in the world are they?" asked a man in the crowd. They were much too large to be men, and not at all like fish or dolphins. "They are horses," said Strange. "Where did they come from?" asked another man. "I made them," said Strange, "out of the sand, out of horse sand, to be precise." "But will they not dissolve?" asked one of the crowd. "And what are they for?" asked Captain Gilby. Strange said, "They are made of sand and seawater and magic, and they will last as long as there is work for them to do. Captain Gilby, get one of the boats to take a message to the captain of the false prelate to say that his men should lash the horses to the ship, as many of them as they can. The horses will pull the ship off the shoal."
"Oh," said Captain Gilby.
"Very well. Yes, of course." Within half an hour of the message reaching the false prelate, the ship was clear of the shoal, and the sailors were busy putting the sails to rights and doing the thousand and one things which sailors do, things which are quite as mysterious in their way as the actions of magicians. However, it ought to be said that the magic did not work quite as Strange intended. He had not imagined there would be much difficulty in capturing the horses. He supposed that the ship would have plenty of ropes to make halters, and he had tried to regulate the magic so that the horses would be as biddable as possible. But sailors in general do not know much of horses. They know the sea, and that is all. Some of the sailors did their best to catch hold of the horses and harness them, but many had not the least idea how to begin, or they were too afraid of the silvery, ghostly creatures to go anywhere near them. Of the 100 horses that Strange created, only about 20 were eventually harnessed to the ship. These 20 were certainly instrumental in pulling the false prelate off the sand, but equally useful was the great trough in the sandbank, which appeared as more and more horses were created out of it. In Portsmouth, opinion was divided over whether Strange had done something glorious in saving the false prelate, or whether he had merely used the disaster to improve his own career. Many of the captains and officers about the place said that the magic he had done had been of a very showy sort, and was obviously intended to draw attention to his own talent and impress the Admiralty more than to save the ship. Nor were they best pleased about the sand horses. These did not just disappear when their work was done, as Strange had said they would. Instead, they swam about Spithead for a day and a half, after which they lay down and became sandbanks in new and entirely unexpected places. The masters and pilots of Portsmouth complained to the port admiral that Strange had permanently altered the channels and shoals in Spithead so that the Navy would now have all the expense and trouble of taking soundings and surveying the anchorage again. However, in London, where the ministers knew as little of ships and seamanship as Strange, only one thing was clear. Strange had saved a ship, the loss of which would have cost the Admiralty a vast amount of money. Thank you. And now if anyone has any questions, I shall be very glad to try and answer them. When I wrote about the historical stuff like Wellington and the war, what kind of research did I do, and what sort of alterations did I make in order to fit the magic into it? I did, the research that I did sort of fell into about, I think, about three areas. I did a lot of general research of the era, and then to do the things that you're talking about, I did a lot of specific research on events that were going in the book, notably the military history, which I discovered I liked very much. I had expected to hate military history, because partly because I'd expected not to understand it very well, and partly because I thought it would be very much boys' stuff and guns and explosions. I discovered it was actually, in many occasions, military history, first of all, it's based very closely on memoirs. Wellington's soldiers, the officers, and the common soldiers, a lot of them wrote memoirs, and these were published. And so you can get a very, very vivid idea, not just of the great events of the battle, but also, you know, what the men were doing the morning before the battle. A Captain Johnny Kincaid, who is a Scottish soldier, described he and his men made a great cauldron full of tea, and all the generals before Waterloo stopped and begged a cup, even Wellington. So that was fun. The sort of the third kind of research that I did was things that seemed to have absolutely nothing to do with the book, but which I somehow felt would come in useful or which caught my interest. And those sorts of things were often quite useful for inventing the magic. They were kind of folkloric stuff. What sort of changes did I make? I tried, when I fitted the magic into the historical background, to think about what would the soldiers actually have found useful. So I studied Waterloo and then thought, well, what did they need? What would have actually helped them win this battle? And, for example, at Waterloo, I discovered one of the things that helped the Allied army, of which the British were a part, was the fact that the French were walking through this thick mud, which kind of meant that they their horses and the foot soldiers kept getting almost stuck in the mud. So I gave that to Strange as something he could create. The other part, and for example, I found for the part I've just read a picture of a ship lying on its side in a book of naval history, and it was such an extraordinary image that I wanted to use that. Did the footnotes come from folklore, or did I make them up? I'm afraid I made them up. almost all. I can't think that any of the little stories. There is one. It's very, very. It's always very dangerous for me to be absolutely definite when talking about this book, because then I suddenly remember, no, actually there was this exception. I think there is one point when Strange is remembering a previous magician, a famous magician called Ralph Stokesy, who was a medieval magician, and how this magician sort of persuaded a very powerful fairy called Col Tom Blue to become his servant. And although that story, which is like a little fairy tale, is made up, it is based upon an English folk tale. It has a lot of similarity to an English folk tale called Kate Crackernuts, in which a young woman rescues an enchanted prince from a fairy palace by persuading fairies to help her, I think by rolling nuts to them. I can't quite remember how it works, but in my footnote, Ralph Stokesy persuades the other fairies to help him by rolling beautiful apples to them. So yes, I did. I think that's the only one. The rest of them, I'm afraid, are entirely made up. I mean, I did read a lot of English folk tales, but that was more to help me with building the fairy world, which I wanted to be quite traditional in feel, because I think the most interesting aspect of the fairies is what people actually believed about them when they believed in fairies. Is the creative process for writing fantasy inspirational, methodic, or journalistic? I have no idea. I think it's a bit of everything, and I suspect also that different writers have different approaches. I would say the fantasy in this book was created kind of organically, by which I mean I had one or two ideas that I liked at the beginning, and then as I began to write the book, I expanded on them. Interestingly enough, at the beginning, I was quite nervous about writing about for the fairy side. And so during the time I was writing this novel, I wrote 7 short stories, and some of those were about fairies. And in those short stories, I sort of built up the fairy world, and then I borrowed that stuff back and put it back into Strange and Norrell. The magic that Strange and Norrell do is largely literary, and so I'm borrowing not so much from actual magic that magicians did when people believed in magic, but more from fantasy books such as C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, and although the magic in Le Guin is different in the Wizard of Earthsea, I very much wanted that feel. She makes you believe in it, so I tried to copy her in that. So it's imitation is a good part of the creative process, borrowing stuff from people. But then I'm sure it varies from writer to writer. How big was the manuscript? How much editing was done? It was, the main thing about this book was, after a certain point, my main concern was that I would not be able to finish. I had never finished a novel before, and I was writing for 10 years, and that's a long time. In year 8, my partner suggested that I get an agent. He said, if you think that someone else believes in this book outside this house, that will help you. And that did. It helped a great deal. So the agent, I think, waited until about year 9. And then he said, right, now I'm going to sell it. And at that point, I had completed the book's in 3 parts. I'd completed the first 2. And I think that was about 800 pages in manuscript, something like that. And I had written a lot of part 3. And he sold it based on those first 2 parts. Not to the first publisher, but to, I think, the 3rd publisher he showed it to. And I believe my editor told me later that she expected at that point, when the final thing was in, that she would ask me to make cuts. And I wasn't at all surprised at that. It was very clear at that point that they were going to use the footnotes, which I'd kind of written for myself because I kind of assumed that any editor would say, take out the footnotes. But when I produced the final 3rd, the editor decided, and I think she was right, that the pacing of the thing was consistent and that it didn't need any major cuts. So what you get is pretty much what I wrote. I think I made cuts in about 2 or 3 chapters, and even they were all in the last part, and they weren't very extensive. So I was very lucky. Where did I come up with the the story of the Raven King, who is this medieval magician king who first creates English magic and then rules over the northern England for, I think, about 300 years before disappearing in, I think, about 1430-something. And people in northern England still expect him to come back. And the second part of the question was do I have a mythology of him that I can draw upon? Not exactly. The first thing is, I'm afraid the Raven King is also completely made up. I didn't draw on any. There is no existing mythology for a character. I just tried to think of the coolest magician I could, and then I went from there. But he was, in a way, I think, the first character that I thought of, or at least he certainly, I created him at the same time as Strange and Norrell, and at one point it wasn't clear whether I was going to write about him or about Strange and Norrell. I know a lot about him that I haven't put in the book, so yes, there probably is. I haven't sort of organised it, I haven't written it down, but yes, there is a lot more to his story that gets hinted at in the book. For example, the names of ships that are mentioned, the name of the ship in that piece I just read, The False Prelate, I think most of the names of the ships refer to incidents in the Raven King's life and history, which I haven't actually written out yet. The False Prelate refers to his first archbishop. And there's names of ships like Thomas of Dundale and William of Lanchester, who are people who were his servants. So yes, there is more. And I'm hoping that one day I will get to that. Absolutely not. None whatsoever. Somebody once asked me, have you been told by your publisher to say it's not a fantasy book? And I said, no. No, it's... They don't. But Bloomsbury, it's interesting, Bloomsbury aren't a publisher of fantasy and science fiction, but they have no problem with it whatsoever. They're just... One thing that has happened is obviously I've done events at science fiction for science fiction groups in the UK, and I went to Worldcon in Glasgow this year, and I always end up though explaining to my publishers how these things work, because this is a totally new world for them, and I sort of have to explain it works a bit different from a normal bookshop event, which of course they know all about. It's an interesting point. The sort of comment and question is that a lot of the time in the novel there are these huge gaps in communication. Characters cannot communicate one to the other. Some of this is, as you say, due to magical forces, and some of it isn't. I think some of it is due to the character of Strange and Norrell, who are both extremely very different types of men, but both extremely self-absorbed. And in a way, I think that's kind of necessary for them, because they are, from nothing, taking this purely academic, theoretical subject and making it practical. And you need people who are extraordinarily focused, maybe to the exclusion of kind of realizing what's going on around them. And also, they're both people who think they're always right, so they don't really take much notice of anybody else. Some of it is to do with, I think, descriptions of the social setup of the early 1900s. For example, some of the characters, there is a whole story concerning a black butler, the son of a slave called Stephen Black. And he is kind of locked in his own story, and none of the other characters ever really realise that he is a major part of their lives. What is happening to them is very much affected by Stephen's actions, but they never know that. So that's kind of interesting. And also the women, because the men in the book love the women in the book. The two central marriages are There is a great deal of love in those two central marriages, but the men don't really take enough notice of what is happening to the women. Some of it, though, is to do with the fact that it's a story about fairy and magic having an influence on England, and therefore there is this secret world that no one is expecting sort of growing up, and some of the magic which is done is about closing off communication. That's as well as I can do. It's a question I haven't really thought about before. How did I feel when I finished the book? Do you know, it was the most extraordinary thing. I expected either to celebrate and have a big party. One time, years ago, I was planning to go away for this holiday. Another time, I was planning to have a big party. Another time, I got really nervous that when I finished, I would get ill. Because I remember when my partner, Colin Greenland, finished a book, he became, one time, he became very sort of depressed and anxious, and for about 2 weeks you could just tell he was empty and drained. And Neil Gaiman, I think, when he finished American Gods, lost his voice and couldn't speak for several days. So I was sort of waiting for something really exciting to happen like that. And nothing did. And it was all a bit of a non-event, really. I think I was so focused, I was so anxious, because I was a little, I think I told them originally I would finish in June, and I actually finished end of September. So I was so sort of focused on just physically getting them the manuscript. I didn't really pay much attention to the fact it was done.
One last question.
What can I tell you about the book I'm working on now? Not a huge amount, because I don't really know that much. It starts a few years after Strange and Norrell finishes. It is focusing on different characters, so it won't be a sequel in a sense, it will be the continuing adventures of Strange and Norrell, but some old characters are definitely going to reappear. And it will be a little bit further down the social scale, because as I was writing Strange and Norrell, I got more interested in the characters at the bottom, or not quite so high. Strange and Norrell are both gentlemen. I got more interested in the lower classes, so there will be a bit more of that, and maybe a bit more focus on the women, and that's about it really. And will it take 10 years? I hope not. But experience seems to show that I am the worst judge in the world of these matters, so who knows? Thank you very much. Yeah.
That's all for tonight's Authors on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Neil Gaiman, Robert Hicks, Monty Roberts, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was recorded on September 15th, 2005.